This lecture tonight on the subject of the flood, which is number 89 in our lecture series, is dedicated to the memory of Yosef ben Shmuel Yehoshua Bernstein by his children and grandchildren, the Grandovsky family of Muncie, New York. Mr. Bernstein's yahrzeit this week is 22 days in Cheshvan. The subject of the flood is one of the most fascinating topics in all of human history. And what makes it really so fascinating is that out of all so-called mythology which exists in the world, it is a story that recurs in almost every culture, in every mythology, which is an attestation to the fact that, A, not only the flood happened, but B, that it had a profound effect on all of humankind, and its effect was felt by all of the different cultures, each interpreting it in its own fashion. Since this is a course in Jewish history, so naturally the interpretation given here is the traditional Jewish interpretation of the events, and therefore, it is not only historic, but it also has within it the qualities of moral teaching, and it has within it the qualities of a glimpse, so to speak, as to how the Creator and nature and the human race work in concert. The biblical version of the story of the flood we all know. It's from the Parsha of Noah that in the 1536th year after creation, a flood came upon the earth. It rained continuously for 40 days and 40 nights. And not only did it rain, but all of the sources of water in the world swelled. And the words of the Talmud that for every drop of rain that fell from heaven, two drops of water came forth from the earth. The seas covered the face of the earth, so that in effect it reverted back to the condition that it was at the time of creation when the earth was covered by the waters and no dry land was visible. In this great flood, everything was destroyed except for naturally the fishes that survive, those that survive in water. And some exceptions. The exceptions were on the boat with Noah, the animal kingdom, the kingdom of the birds, of insects, of crawling things, and Noah and his family survived. The rabbis also tell us that the great king Og, the giant Og Melech HaBoshan, he also survived. He was a stowaway. He hung on to the outside of the boat, and he survived the mabul. At the end of our discussion tonight, I believe we'll have a little time. I'd like to discuss what, I think there's a particular insight, an historic insight into the way the rabbis describe it. But in any event, after a period of time, months, the waters settle again. The dry land reappears, the boat docks on the mountain of Ararat, which most scholars today say are somewhere in northern Turkey, close to the border with Iraq. And there are expeditions that are sent out on a fairly regular basis to try and find the remains of Noah's Ark. Until now, they have not really been that successful. But it would be well worth it, right? They could sell pieces of wood from Noah's Ark. It would probably be a lucrative business. And the story continues how civilization developed after that from this one family, from the family of Noah. And in fact, the Talmud then calls all of the human beings in the world B'nai Noah, the children of Noah, the descendants of Noah. And the civilization moves on in its present form. Our rabbis tell us it's 10 generations from Adam to Noah, 10 generations from original man to Noah, and in the count of the years, it's 1,536 years. 1,526 years, I'm sorry. And we have an exact date of when it occurred. Except there always is, to prove that it's Jewish, there are two dates, two conflicting opinions. One is that it began raining on the 17th of Iyar, and the other opinion is it began raining on the 17th of Mar Cheshvan, which is appropriately tonight. And it is raining in Muncie. The dispute, the six-month dispute, is the same dispute as to when the world was created, whether we count time from the first of Nisan or we count time from the first of Tishrei. So depending how we count time then, so then the order of the months will be the same as to whether we count the flood from the 17th of Iyar or the 17th of Cheshvan. It's one of the reasons why, by the way, Cheshvan is called Mar Cheshvan. It has an additional name to it. Mar meaning a drop, or like a drop of water, Kemar Midli, water from the pail, because it is since we adopt the opinion that the world was created in Tishrei, and that's why we have Rosh Hashanah in Tishrei, etc. So therefore, we also adopt the opinion that the flood was on the 17th of Cheshvan, and in commemoration of the flood, so therefore, the month itself has the name water built into it, Mar Cheshvan. Also included in the word Mar is the bitterness, because it's not a happy anniversary. We are talking about the great cataclysmic destruction of the human race, of millions of people. What we fear now in nuclear holocaust, and it's of little comfort to us that the Medrash says that there will not be another flood of water, but that there can very well be another flood of fire. So we are capable of doing it again. And because of that, therefore we call it Mar, it's bitter, because it's a bitter memory. I think what makes it even more bitter is the fact that very little has been learned from the memory, which is probably the bitterest lesson of all, is that mankind not only repeats history, but forgets it, treats it in a fashion that it's of no value to it. So we have the story of the flood as recorded in the Chumash. Now, we also have the story of the flood that's recorded in a Babylonian text from the 19th century before the Common Era. So we're talking about a text that is in itself today close to 4,000 years old, which already is pretty close to the time of the flood. Because if the flood was 1526 and we're 5747, so with fast calculations it's about 4,200 and some years. And here you're talking about a text that is 4,000 years old. It is found in a place in Babylonia called Nippur, and it describes the flood, that everyone was drowned, and that there was a great boat, and that out of that great boat the family of man came and existed. It's a very close correlation with the version that we know, except that it has in it paganistic references that the god of water is the one that drowned the world, and he overcame the god of the dry land, and that's how it's written. We also have later texts. We have an Assyrian text from the 7th century before the Common Era, which is about 2,700 years old, and that text alludes to the fact that it is being copied from an earlier text. But there also you have the story of the flood, you have the story of one family surviving, and you have the story of how mankind developed from that family. In the Greek literature, the Greek author Pindar, in the 5th century before the Common Era, has an epic poem about the flood. And it is also a couched in Greek mythology in the war of the gods between each other. But it is still, again, the same basic story of the flood. What makes it even more interesting is that in India, in Sanskrit, in the Brahmana, which was written in the 6th century before the Common Era, it is also described in the same fashion. And the anthropologists who have studied the primitive tribes of southern Asia, in Borneo, in Sri Lanka, in New Guinea, the Aborigines in Australia, all have a common legend regarding the Great Flood. And in fact, that's how they say that they got to where they got. That's how they came. They all say they came from somewhere else, but that after the Great Flood, they dispersed and they came by boat to these far-out islands in the world. The American Indians and the Eskimos and the Aleuts also have the same legend, as do many of the tribes in South America. There even is anthropological evidence that the Chinese have such a legend, also regarding the Great Flood. And because of all of that, it seems universally accepted that there is a common basis to all of these stories. The only group that the anthropological experts have not found any legend regarding the flood are the blacks in Africa. For that, there's also a Medrash, because of the fact of what happened to Chum, the father of the black tribe, after the flood, and that he was banished by the other brothers and cursed, and that the various things happened to him. So it was like erased from the book, and that they started over without the previous tradition. But except for that, I did some research on it, even in the encyclopedia, article in the Encyclopedia Britannica. They quote Russian legends and legends from the Caucasians and from the Mongols. It is an extreme. There is no story that is as widespread in human folklore as the flood. And then there's a great deal of geological evidence of a flood, of shifts in the earth, how it happened, all of which points out that this great cataclysmic event occurred, and it had a profound impact naturally upon its generation. At the risk of saying the worst pun of the series, we could say that it really was a watershed in human history, because everything is seen as being either before the flood or after the flood. And that's true in the Jewish viewpoint of the world, what happened before the flood and the world after the flood, and that's seen generally in the world as being the dividing line in all of the cultures. What makes it, to me, extremely fascinating, I never know how to deal with it. One of the things that I researched, I mentioned to you, I just glanced at that article in the Encyclopedia Britannica on the flood. So he brings all the evidence, and at the end he says, well, this is a folk myth that arose somewhere, you know, like it couldn't be. It's got to be a made-up story, but he can't explain how this made-up story went all over the world, which is the bias of Western secular man. Western secular man always begins with the bias that whatever is in the Bible cannot be true. That the Bible is not a legitimate record of man, though everything scientifically points the other way. For instance, all the archaeology based on the Bible, you look where the Bible says it is and it's there. The entire archaeology in the Middle East is based upon the Bible. Nevertheless, none of the archaeologists believe in the Bible. It's a phenomena that of blindness. I once saw an article written by a great historian who said that the entire story of Purim is a myth. It never could have happened, that it never did happen, and that it's all a myth. So I was young and foolish then. Now I'm old and foolish. So I wrote him a letter. I remember I was in the yeshiva, and I was so furious. I wrote him a letter, and I said, I don't understand. He said, here is a historical book with names, with dates, with places, with eyewitnesses, kept alive by a people that is not noted for their naivete or for primitive beliefs. And you discard it, that it doesn't count as a historic record, but what someone scribbles on a cave, that you don't can't even decipher it. No, that's history. That's valid. So he wrote me back and he answered me. He said, well, he said, your bias is showing, he wrote. That's unfortunate. It really is unfortunate. And this is just another example of it, of the fact that my bias is showing. Because it defies description why we should not look at it differently. Just as another aside, but it's an important aside, there's an article in today's New York Times about the cosmology of the world and how now all of a sudden they've discovered that the universe is far more than they ever thought it was, and that they have to scrap all their theories. Well, what happened to what happened to everything that went before? To scrap all your theories, right? But we're wrong, right? They're right. That's a terrible bias. It's not correct. So if the rabbis came and said that they give you a date, it happened on the 17th of Mar Cheshvan in the year 1500 and whatever it is, 4200 years ago, that date, that place, and it started here and it ended up there, that's not history. That's not fair. It really is not fair. Not fair scientifically. I'm not talking in terms of belief. A person can believe as he wishes. But historically, it cannot be discarded. And again, the common denominator, the fact that it is seen throughout the world, and not only the reasons for it are the same. I saw this translation of the Sanskrit document from India. So there it says that the world was destroyed by, and it lists, 16 different gods, but it was destroyed because it said violence, lust, robbery, and the lack of unity among mankind. So that the ancient world did not see it as a random occurrence. They didn't see, it's a great flood, a tidal wave came, an iceberg broke off. I'm looking at travel brochures about Alaska. It gets me in mood for the winter. So one of the brochures describes the formation of the Alaskan glaciers and how icebergs are made. A piece of the glacier falls off, that becomes the iceberg. So it says that there's a piece hanging now that's so big that if it falls off, it'll flood Seattle. It'll make a tidal wave that'll flood Seattle. I mean, and they write it in the program like you're supposed to go look at that, right? Maybe they guarantee it won't fall off while you're in Seattle on their tour. But the amazing thing regarding it is that all of this natural phenomena leads nowhere. There is no philosophy. There's no bottom line that ties it in, so why doesn't it fall off? The ancients, whatever their deficiencies in science may have been, even the pagans in the ancient world, did not believe in things happening at random. And therefore, all natural phenomena had some sort of meaning. And great natural catastrophes, disasters, changes, transformations had special meaning. And therefore, the Sanskrit article, the Sanskrit writing in India that talks about the great flood looks for a moral cause for the great flood. It isn't that it just rained a lot. It was a moral cause. And the moral cause lies at the heart of the issue. The Chumash describes for us the moral cause. That man organized his civilization in such a way that, in the words of the Chumash, Vatimole ho'oretz chomos, the earth was filled with oppression. The earth was filled with robbery. And the rabbis say that God could overlook the paganism. He could even overlook the immorality. He could overlook everything, but he could not overlook the fact that the world was lawless, that the world was just so full of robbery, that the weak had no protector, that society in effect broke down. It was all Dodge City. I hope that you're from the generation still knows what Dodge City is. I spoke about Dodge City in the yeshiva this week, and half of them came over and asked me, what is Dodge City? They thought, you know, it sells cars or something. But that it's all the Wild West, right? Everybody can shoot it out for themselves. And that moral breakdown lies at the heart of the story of the flood. The Rabboni Shel Olam, God tells Noach that there's a 120-year hiatus here between the threat of the flood and between the actuality of the flood coming into being. And that 120 years, the world hears warnings about it but does not take it seriously. Unfortunately, in all disasters, natural, political, diplomatic, military, economic, there always are warnings beforehand. But because of the fact that the inertia factor is so great with man, it's very hard for anybody really to do something about it, even on an individual basis, let alone on a communal basis. So the world sinks into that abyss until there is nothing left. Our rabbis also tell us that as long as there were 10 righteous people in the world, 9 righteous people, God makes the 10th, which shows us the rabbi's viewpoint of God's mercy. One thing God is not is a yekeh. Right? God made he made dominion himself. So as long as Meshuselah was in the world, as long as Methuselah was still alive, so then the flood didn't come. One righteous person can hold back the gates of the flood. And that's always the emphasis in Jewish life on good people, on righteous people, on the value of the individual. You say, what good is one person in a world of 4.5 billion? Say, he's good, so what? Does that make it? So Gorbachev became better. Arafat, I mean, what changed here, right? Because I gave charity today, or I did a good deed, or I visited the sick, or I put on tefillin, what difference does it make? The world is as it is. Well, that's only if you read the New York Times and you look at the world in those eyes, then you say, well, you're right. What difference does it make? But it makes a great difference. And that's the point the rabbis wanted to make to us, that the difference lies at the heart of how we view humanity, how we view the world. The whole world is because of me. The Rambam says in his famous discourse in Hilchus Tshuva that a person should always feel that he is 50-50 when he comes to do something. He's 50% guilty and 50% holy. And that the whole world is 50% guilty and 50% holy. And that the next thing that I do decides the fate. So it's not only my fate that it decides the fate of humanity as well. If people would think that way, then they certainly would behave differently. They certainly would see it differently. It would give an importance to life that many times doesn't exist. It's very hard to feel anything if you stand in a crowd of hundreds of thousands and you feel that you're insignificant. What can I do? One of the feelings that I have in New York City, in the lunch hour at Rockefeller Center, have to go meet someone. You see hundreds of thousands. I mean, who am I? What am I going to stop? What can I do? So Maimonides says that one should have in mind that what he does, that's the balance of the world. That's the moral lesson that underlies the flood. Now that's the story of civilization thereafter, because civilization thereafter is really not the story of millions of people. It's the story of individuals, and really relatively few individuals. That's true in our world also. In the 20th century in the United States, you can probably name 400 people, 500 people that have made the 20th century in the United States, even though millions and millions and millions of people have existed here in this country, hundreds of millions of people, maybe billions. But I think you can make an accurate list of 500 people. You say, well, you're right, those 500 people, that's our century. They are the ones that have had the effect upon it. They're the ones that have changed it. They're the ones that have molded it. It's for good or for evil, for strength or for weakness, but they're the ones that did it. And that is the view throughout the Tanakh of history. That history, Zeh Sefer Toldos Odom. This is the book of the history of man. It not only means man in the broad sense of mankind, it's the story of little men, of individual men, of small men. And that's how the Chumash, the Tanakh, tells us every story. Every story is related as an individual story of an individual person, of an individual family, of everyday incidents that happened to them, and that these incidents had transcendental cosmic purpose. And that only by appreciating that and dealing with it in that fashion are we able to truly appreciate what the Torah is trying to tell us, the values that the Torah is trying to convey to us in the story of human history. The rabbis always phrase it that way. They say, Bram Zochur Oso Ish Latov. This man shall be remembered for good. He did a good thing, so he's remembered for good. They wrote him down in the Talmud. And then they wrote down other people, you know, that they would like to pay money to get their name out of it, to have their name removed. And that's the custom that we have, that when Zecher Tzadik Levrocha V'Shem Rishoyim Yirkam, that the memory of the righteous is a blessing. So if you say the name of a person that was a good person, so you all, in Jewish tradition, we always say the memory of the righteous is a blessing. Just mentioning his name is a blessing. And the name of a Rosha is a destruction, right? So we have an imprecation that we say, a curse that we say. You mention the name of someone, of a very evil person. Why? Well, I mean, it's only one person. And because the whole story of civilization is the story of one person, of individuals, of small amounts of people. It's not, in the vastness of all the billions, we're really only telling a story of individuals, of a few people. And that's the way the story of the flood is presented here. That God destroys all of mankind and he rebuilds it through one family. Through the family of Noah. They had their wives with them in the ark. Noah, there were four men and four women. That's how you get the nine, right? And Methuselah was nine and God was ten. And that they did not have children till after they left the ark. Now, the rabbis tell us that after the water settled, so there were a great many corpses in the world, as one can imagine, millions of bodies. And the rabbi said they settled in great valleys. And the Talmud says that most of those valleys were in Mesopotamia and Babylonia and Bovel. And therefore, in Jewish tradition and in the viewpoint of the Jewish world, Bovel was always the mass cemetery of the world. Because there was most of mankind buried. It's also interesting that there's a medrash that says that bodies were transported by the flood and deposited in Africa. I often think about Dr. Leakey and his bones that he's finding, you know, old bones that you find in Kenya. So we have to hope that it just doesn't end up that those bones are, you know, from Mendelowitz's butcher shop, but because a lot of the evolutionary bones that have been found 100 years later turn out to be very either frauds or mistakes or who knows what. But there's no question that there are ancient bones that came to Africa, because the flow of the waters after the flood brought corpses to Africa. So the two places of the burial of the flood, the main place the rabbi says in Bovel, but there's a medrash that also says that they were buried in Africa, and that was the place. Noah, the survivor of the flood, the Torah tells us and the Medrash tells us, was in shock. Nobody can experience such a terrible cataclysmic event and come out normal, so to speak, afterwards. We know, without making exact comparisons, but people that survive such events are traumatized by that. They have to be. And how they deal with that trauma, that's the measure of normalcy, that's the measure of greatness. Some come out greater, some never recover. But all are unalterably affected. It cannot be the same. And Noah was not the same. So before the flood, the Torah describes Noah in the most glowing terms, as a righteous person, as a God-fearing person, as the supreme example of a good person. And the Torah gives him titles of greatness. After the flood, he's just plain Mr. Noah. There is very little complimentary record of him. In fact, the Torah gives us another viewpoint of him. And the insight here that I believe that the Mefarshim all comment is that after the flood, Noah was a different man. The guilt of having watched millions of people die and he survived, that's a big peckle to carry. It's a big burden. And it's one of the, all psychologists and psychiatrists are able to identify that certain people who survive a tragedy that others are destroyed in, so they carry the guilt all of their life of having survived. Even though it's not their fault. Noah certainly had guilt that because it was his fault, he felt. Because he had warned the world for 120 years and nobody listened to him, so he felt maybe he wasn't an effective salesman. Our first reaction is, I told you so. Our first reaction is good, right? You didn't listen to me. Good, you deserve it. But when that reaction dies within us, as it eventually does, it is replaced by a reaction of remorse, of sadness, of trepidation, of a realization of what has happened and what I was witness to and what I participated in. And it's very, very, very difficult to be sanguine about it. Very, very difficult to be sanguine about it. I remember the great Rabbi Kalmanovitz, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, was the head of the Mir Yeshiva, and who was one of the great leaders of the Vod HaTzolah during the Holocaust, and who went on Shabbos to Washington to beg the Secretary of Defense and the Jewish Secretary of the Treasury to intercede to try and save Jews. So in his later years, he was in Miami Beach. He used to come for the winters. In fact, he died in Miami Beach. And we had to be flown up in a private airplane in order to avoid embalming. A whole story. I can tell you a whole adventure story. Rabbi Rotman took care of all the arrangements. It's a whole story. But when he was in, he was a very emotional person. Very emotional person. And he was a person that would weep at the slightest thing, he would weep. So somebody once asked him, you know, Rebbe, what are you crying about so? He said, you don't understand. He said, I saw what happened. And I'm a living witness to what happened. So he said, you know, I can't control it. It's part of me. And we find the same description in the prophet Jeremiah. He says, Ani agever. In Eicha, I'm the man that saw it. I'm the man that saw it. So that's you can't hold me by normal standards anymore. And that's what happened to Noah. And that colored what happened with his children, and really that colored what happened with civilization, because it left such a trauma that it did not easily survive. And that's what our rabbis mean when they say it's 10 generations from Adam to Noah. And 10 generations then from Noah to Avraham. Avraham could not have come in the next generation. In the next generation, there couldn't have been an Avraham. Because the trauma was too great. They're just unable to deal with it. Unable to deal with the fact that the entire world was destroyed. What was nature like before the Mabul, before the flood, and after the flood? Well, that also is a great difference of opinion in rabbinic thinking, and it's a great difference of opinion in scientific thinking. It's not clear to us. For instance, we have, at least we postulate, that there were all sorts of great creatures that once roamed this earth. You go to the American Museum of Natural History, you know, you got the dinosaur that meets you in front. You know, that enormous, I don't know how they put it together with the skeleton. I don't know if it's real, if those bones are there. If it looks like it, it doesn't look like it. But there were such animals in the world, such creatures. And the Talmud records for us many creatures that became extinct. So most of the Mephorshim say that was before the flood. That's in English, it's antediluvian and post-diluvian. Before the deluge and after the deluge. It was a different world then. And that depends on a philosophic dispute whose main antagonist in Jewish scholarship are Maimonides, the Rambam on one hand, and the Ramban, Nachmanides, on the other hand. The Rambam is of the opinion that nature is immutable. It never changes. Whatever was, is. And that's the way God set it up, and there will be no changes. And the Rambam says not only was there no difference before the flood, after the flood, but there'll be no difference, for instance, in the world to come at the time of the Messiah. It said there'll be no differences. Whatever you see, that's what it is. Muncie will never have the climate of Miami Beach. Nothing changes within the general structure of nature. The Ramban disagrees, and he disagrees vehemently. And most of the Mephorshim, most Jewish tradition follows Nachmanides, follows the Ramban. And that is that in the period before the flood was a different nature than what exists now. I mean, the main problem is with all these people who lived all these tremendously long years, 700 years, 800 years, 900 years, and all of a sudden, you know, there is such a drop. I mean, the insurance companies got flooded out, right? All their actuarial tables were based on people living 900 years, and people started dying 100 years, 90 years, 80 years, 70 years. Always have to look at things through the business point of view. So it was a what happened? So the Ramban says, well, it was a different world then. He said it was a different world, a different nature, pure oxygen. He says, yes.
How do you explain the transitional?
What, like the 180?
The ones who lived in both worlds.
The only one that lived in both worlds was Noah and his children. No, Methuselah died before the flood. The only one that survived is Noah and the. But again, apparently those that were born, I mean, the answer is that those that were born before the flood had the genetics to live long. And those that were born after the flood, the genetic mutation took place already. That's how Og, for instance, lived all the hundreds of years until the time that Moshe dispatched him. But in any event, you're talking about a different world, different nature. So again, I just, to quote an article that appeared in the Times, I think 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, that they discovered that that at one time on Earth there was purer oxygen than there is today. And that somehow the atmosphere was different on Earth. So it could be that there were creatures. It could be that the climate was different and there were different creatures. The Chumash tells us that before the flood, everyone was herbivorous. Everyone ate vegetables only. There was no meat eaten neither by man nor by animals. And so that fits in, by the way, with the theory of these gigantic animals who all, according to all accounts of the scientists, ate vegetables and plants. And were not beasts of prey. But that after the flood, again, the Medrash in its own way says that they had nothing to eat, so they began to eat from the corpses. And vultures, carrion, that type of animals existed. And man was given, that says Mefarish in the Torah, that man was given permission to kill other creatures in order to feed himself. And that's because of the state of the world after the flood. Before the flood, he was not given that permission at all. And the Abarbanel says in his commentary, again, he says it medically, he says because of the fact that their nature changed, that now they needed it. They had no source of protein, they had no source of food. They were unable to exist purely on that type of diet. He also says that it would have taken years to restore the agricultural balance in the world, and that somehow they had to have at least food temporarily, and therefore all of that is what happened. The rabbis also tell us that there was a change in species that occurred. It's an interesting medrash here. I'm going to quote it. The medrash appears in the Pirkei de Rebbe Elezer. It says, "Ad shalobo amabul hoyu atmei merubim min atahorim." Before the mabul, there were the species, the animals in the world that were tomei were much, much more numerous than those that were tahor. Rotso HaKadosh Baruch Hu laharbos es atahorim alamayet es atmeim. God wanted to change the balance of nature somehow, to change the ecology of nature. Kora l'noach v'yomar lo haveloch el ateva mikol behema tahora. So all of the kosher species, so to speak, survived the flood. But not all of the non-kosher species survived the flood. I imagine there was not enough room for the dinosaurs. Took along baby elephants. But they were not on the teva, the Medrash says. They were not brought on. So it was like a conscious decision. And according to the Medrash, Noach didn't go gathering the animals. It was an instinct that brought those that were to be saved, brought them to the ark, and the others didn't come. So it was like an instinct within them for their own salvation and an instinct for their own destruction, which, again, can be placed, if one wishes, in modern scientific terms and understood in that fashion. It need not be, but it can be because of the fact that there is an instinct. There's an instinct among animals to jump off of cliffs and kill themselves also when the time comes. That's the instinct that the Medrash is talking about here. Yes. Well, it means tahora is, for instance, those animals that chew their cud and have split hooves. would be considered kosher animals in the animal kingdom, and those birds that are kosher that we eat, and those fish that are kosher that we eat. No, no, he did. I didn't say he only gathered the kosher. I said that all of the kosher survived, whereas not all of the non-kosher survived. I want to point out that the idea that the Medrash tells us here. Our rabbis also tell us that during the period of the time of the flood, the universe was suspended. Whatever, however we understand that. But that time stopped. The sun and the moon did not function, the Medrash says. The constellations, nothing moved in its orbit. It was a state of suspended animation. And therefore, that would affect naturally everything else that we talk about in terms of measuring time and space, and measuring rays of light that come from other stars. In all of our understanding of all the natural phenomena, according to the Medrash, we can only understand till the time of the flood. What went on before the flood is impossible for us to measure. We have no basis by which we can come to any realization as to what went on before. The Rambam, by the way, the doctor to the very end, you know, my son the doctor, the Rambam. So the Rambam says that the reason that everybody, there are 38 people who are listed in the beginning of Bereishis as having lived extraordinarily long lives, so the Rambam says those people took care of themselves. That's what the Rambam says. The Rambam says they were careful. They, you know, they ate a balanced diet, and they did exercise, and they went to sleep on time, and they weren't type A people, and they didn't operate under stress. So the Rambam says, if you take care of yourself, you can live 900 years, if you want to. Most people apparently don't want to. So that probably contributes to our type of behavior as well. But it's interesting how far the Rambam goes with his theory that nature does not change. So even on that, which is a very difficult point to deal with, the length of life, etc., so he explains it naturally. He just merely says that they took care of themselves. Our rabbis say that that's based on the verse, Tzohar Ta'ase La'Teva, that they made a window, a skylight for the ark. So Rashi there brings both opinions. One opinion was that it was a window and the light shone in. The other opinion is that there was no light, which I've just discussed with you. There was no light. So there was an artificial light. He had electricity on the ark. He had some sort of reflection of a precious stone, some sort of material that gave off light, quartz, neon, something. That glowed and gave him light and enabled him to be there. Also, it's an interesting point that they can't imagine that he would have existed without light, because that's like human beings are completely that stir crazy is that you're, you know, 40 days in the darkness. So that makes no difference. You never recover from that. If you've ever visited any of the dungeons in the medieval castles in Europe, you know, so they take you down for a tour, and you hope they let you out. But the most frightening thing is the darkness. It's the darkness is beyond description. And that's the greatest terror. And that's been used today by, unfortunately, the uncivilized civilized, who use that also as a weapon. So when all the time that Noah was in the ark, the weapon of darkness was not used against him. God provided him with some sort of light, because otherwise he would not have been able to survive the ordeal. Our rabbis say that when Noah left the ark, he became an agricultural settler. He planted a vineyard. So again, it is said in a non-complimentary fashion. That isn't what Noah should have done. Noah should not have planted a vineyard. That was not the first thing the world needed. And from it came a disaster that we talk about next week already in the development of civilization, how that family destroyed itself. And in destroying itself, so that's our antecedents in civilization. Again, war, competition, the whole chance for a unified, strong world is frittered away by the family, as though that is a natural thing for which there is no cure. The only cure is when Avraham comes and rebuilds a family, albeit a small family, but a family that will remain as a unit throughout history. Now, we know that our family also likes to fight amongst itself. It has that unfortunate quality. But nevertheless, as a family unit, the Jewish people have lasted longer than any other family unit. And that basically we still are a family. It's just that we don't always get along with each other, which is true, unfortunately, many times of regular families, of smaller families. But this idea of Noach, of his becoming a vintner, of his planting grapes and producing wine and getting drunk, the rabbis say, a bad start for a new world. But again, you can only not justify it, because we're not talking here about justification. The rabbis understood it in terms of the trauma of Noah. Noah was not looking anymore to be the hero. He was not looking anymore. That's what the rabbis say, the difference between Noah and Avraham. Avraham rose to every occasion. And after every occasion, no matter how traumatized, Avraham strengthens himself for the next test. Noah was destroyed by it. And in his self-destruction, he was unable to rise to any other. So he wanted to retire. Leave me alone. Noach becomes an anti-hero. He becomes just plain Noach. That's really the interpretation. Vayishoer ach Noach. At the end, only Noach was left. Not Noach ish tzadik, not the righteous man, not the man that was righteous in his generations, not the man that even built the ark, not the man that warned the world, not the prophet, not the orator. Ach, Noach, just plain Noach, just leave me alone. Just let me be. Let me live out the rest of my days in peace. And in there we also see a reflection of ourselves. Finally, the last point that I want to make in our discussion here regarding the flood and the impact that it had upon the world is that it implanted within human beings a seed that still is there today, and that is that the world is a very fragile place. It's a very, very dangerous place. And that the possibility of destruction is never far from us. Now, in our time, so we think in terms of nuclear holocaust. But the truth of the matter is that before there was nuclear holocaust, man was always worried about the apocalypse. He was always worried that the end of days is here. He was always worried that the plague would come and destroy him, just as, for instance, Europe. Europe, to a great extent, never recovered from the Black Death, from the bubonic plague, because of the fact that that made such an impression upon civilization that it changed how man thought about himself. In our time, there are plagues and problems and destruction that lurk, and we're afraid of it. To a great extent, we're so afraid that sometimes we're afraid to call it by name. I just saw in the paper that the psychiatrists say that one of the great breakthroughs in the treatment of malignancies is that people call it by its name now. That for centuries, people didn't call it by its name. You wouldn't say it. Because saying it automatically was doom. And that there are many, many such examples in Western man, many, many such examples within us of terrors that exist that are so terrible that we don't even say their name. But deep down within us, or not so deep down, almost at the surface, they're there. So in part of the campaign against nuclear holocaust and against nuclear energy and against nuclear arms, etc., say that should not be seen merely as a campaign against the bomb or against nuclear weapons. It's a campaign against what frightens us. It's a conscious attempt by man somehow to will away the fragile nature of our world. A flood, you stand in awe. What can you do? How can you stop it? I don't know if anyone here has ever seen a tidal wave. I hope not. But I once saw a very small tidal wave off of Florida. It is frightening beyond belief, and that tidal wave was not a big one at all. But you just see this wall of water coming up. What can you do about it? And those people who experienced, for instance, recently the earthquake in California. And there's a whole, in California, by the way, there are many psychiatrists. I think there are more psychiatrists per square inch in California than anywhere else in the world. H.L. Mencken's famous remark that he said that God stood America on end and everything that was loose fell to California. But there's a whole, I saw a whole write-up that they're very busy counseling people who are under the trauma of the earthquake. And the trauma is because, it's a fire, you can run away from the fire. You can do something, right? Or you fool yourself that you can do something. But the earthquake is that the earth rumbles under you. I mean, your whole underpinnings are gone. There's no stability. That's an awful, awful feeling. It's the physical feeling of fright is beyond the ability of human beings to deal with it. Well, that feeling, the flood awakened within man and implanted in man's conscious memory until today. So that, as I mentioned to you at the beginning, that there's a common legend that exists in all cultures that the flood occurred, but the really common legend that proves to us that it existed is ourselves, is how fragile we feel in the world. How frightened we are of every type of disaster. Who knows? Because genetically we remember that there was a moment that the world was destroyed and that it's perfectly capable of doing it again and of occurring again. And because of that, there's that underlying fear which colors all civilization. It colors everything that we do. It affects all of our things. And that is therefore the idea that the Chumash wanted us to see in the story of the flood. The Chumash didn't come necessarily as a history book to record to us dates and events alone. It came to point out to us this inherent quality that exists within all of us, the inherent quality of trepidation, of fear, of uncertainty, and of the fact that we are subject to a control that is not within our hands. We are not the ones who are the ultimate arbiters of what's going to happen. So in a positive sense, that brings about belief, that brings about positive purpose in life. It gives a dimension to life that otherwise it would not have. In a negative sense, it brings about a terrible, terrible fear, terror of the unknown, a superstitious quality. It's like whistling past the graveyard, which in human civilization has occurred many, many times. An ostrich attitude because of the fact that we are so frightened of the fact, because genetically we know that it did happen and therefore it can happen, and that uncertainty is reflected in our behavior and in civilization generally.